15% off everything you can fit inside the bag is back at Menards. Make painting easier by using a one-coat product. Grand Distinction is an interior paint and primer in one that will give your home a fresh, updated look. Right now, get 15% off Pittsburgh products and all the painting supplies you can fit inside the bag through January 12th. See store for complete details. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decade Project. This is One Heat Minute Productions Patreon podcast where we look back a decade ago to see the films that are still kicking around in our culture. And there are some that are really dominant. You know, in the last few weeks, you might have heard on our Patreon, or if you're listening to this on the main feed, maybe a week ago, you would have heard us talk about 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, for example, which now has a sequel. You could hear us talk about a Marvel movie, which obviously is a never-ending franchise, seemingly, that is in the world. But this is a kind of special one because this movie that I'm talking about today was instantly subcultural and subterranean in our consciousness, but has still hung around and clawed and stuck almost in the deep-seated parts of your subconscious from the second that you saw it. It is a sensational movie, and I'm joined by a sensational person to talk about it. The movie that we're covering today is Dan Gilroy's 2014 thriller about the cannibalistic properties of contemporary media, Nightcrawler, and who better to talk about it than the man on LA Crime, the author of my favorite book of maybe almost ever. Everybody knows, a dear friend of mine, the legendary Jordan Harper. Jordan, welcome to talk about Nightcrawler, a movie that people say this pejoratively, that you made it your personality, but literally this is a movie that you made your personality during researching of one of your many upcoming projects where you Lou Bloomed it out there and listened to police scanners and did your research about LA crime culture. I can't wait to talk to you about this movie. Tell me about your love of Nightcrawler. It's so great to talk to you again.
Hey, oh man, it's so much fun to be back.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. I'm a hard worker. I set high goals. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No, I'm not hiring.
We're first! Go around, get a shot inside the car!
Hey, back away.
I got it, I'm back.
Will this be on television?
Morning news, if it bleeds, it leads.
Are you currently hiring?
I'm starting a TV news business.
You, get back!
I film breaking stories. Maybe you saw my item this morning, you were fatal carjacking.
No, I mean, I don't have a TV.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
Does it have GPS?
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're hired.
Okay.
Who are
we're taking the next right. Good, stupid!
You beat the police.
I will never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself.
Excuse me. I have something you'll be very excited about.
You have a good eye. I want you to contact me when you have something.
Something like this.
Think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
You will be seeing me again.
Any unit, residential 211.
A home invasion.
You gotta call the cops.
And we will, at the right time.
But I don't know what to do.
We're gonna find the person that drove that car.
Start filming.
I'm Detective Fonieri.
I think you withheld information.
That would be a very unprofessional thing for me to do.
It would be murder.
I want what you promised me. I want something people can't turn away from.
911, what's your emergency?
Oh my God!
I think Lou is inspiring all of us to reach a little higher.
Anytime, but especially to talk about this movie, which, you know, I would love to hear other opinions, but I think it's probably the best movie of 2014, or at least it's up there.
I mean, watching it again just to chat to you, I was like, it's a perennial question. I haven't really talked too much. In a couple of episodes, I have mentioned it. My favorite movie of that year at the time, you know, I was more into that poppy, you know, popular sort of stuff. It was kind of hanging around. I was like, oh, I love those Guardians of the Galaxy, super fun. You know, I was, you know, 10 years ago, I got married 10 years ago. I was in a really happy mood. But the movie that actually stuck around for me amongst things like Nightcrawler was a movie called Calvary, starring Brendan Gleeson, which is about a priest who gets a confession from someone in the town of you know, their abuse at the hands of the church, and gets a warning that 7 days later he's going to die. So that might be still my favorite. It's still sticking out there. But man alive, Nightcrawler, Jordan, is unbelievable. Pound for pound, beat for beat. Actor for actor,
Riz Ahmed just kind of sliding in and being amazing, Rene Russo being amazing, Bill Paxton being amazing.
Holy
and then
hell.
Obviously like Gyllenhaal doing what I think Gyllenhaal does best, which is not being a normal leading man. It is being a weirdo freak, and he is such a weirdo freak. And but this is in many ways, I think it was trying to do a lot. Thank you for your kind words about Everybody Knows. Due to the LA crime world, what I've been trying to do, which is drag it into the now.
Yes.
Now, this is now a decade later. So there are things about this movie that are the world's completely different place now. But what he was trying to do was tell a story about America and through LA, which is the best way to tell a story about America is to tell a story about LA. That's my position.
Yes.
That LA is the great American city. And I don't want to cannibalize too much from the monologue from my character that you're talking about from my new book. But I think that he is, you know, another thought I'm going to ping pong around here until I zero in is I rewatched this last week in preparation for talking to you. And one of the first thoughts I had was trying to make a list of other movies that could plausibly be named American Psycho. Other than American Psycho.
Yes.
And this is a movie that could be called American Psycho and it would work just as well as it
Perfectly.
Does for the other movie.
Perfectly.
The Killer Inside of Me was the other movie I thought of that you could call American Psycho, because it is not just a psychopath in America, but it is the story of how acting like an absolute psychopathic monster is the key to success in the world that we have built. And all of those shows or stories in their different ways kind of do that. Killer Inside of Me, not maybe it's one for one, but American Psycho is the story of whether or not he's hallucinating or telling the truth, that being a soulless monster, an interchangeable cog, but the right interchangeable cog in the New York financial markets, that will both drive you to become a psychopath, but also will reward you for it. Or at the very least, they don't care.
They don't care.
But this movie goes a step further, and Louis Bloom is portrayed as a just a completely empty shell of a person with nothing but malignancy inside, that wears this like grinning, like kind of salesman smile that doesn't fool anybody, and has these phrases that he says, all these inane business isms that he's picked up and that he regurgitates, and that nobody buys. Like, nobody he meets falls for him for a second, and it still works.
It's almost like, and I just want to add one in there, a true crime version. The Jinx could have been called American Psycho.
The Jinx could have been called American Psycho. That would easily also have worked.
Yeah. Easily. But it's also that he's so nakedly crazy.
Yes.
Everything about the performance. And it's even like, you know, quickly catapulting us from 2014 to 2024. It's like Jake Gyllenhaal does the movie Roadhouse, the remake that's on Amazon. When I watch Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie, I'm like, Jake Gyllenhaal should have been the villain in Roadhouse. Like,
yes.
like the kind of quasi normal guy that he is as the replacement Dalton or whatever his new name is in the new Roadhouse. I'm like, no, he's crazy. Like, right from the second, his silly little topknot riding on a bike that he's stolen in the middle of his store to get store credit, to get his first camcorder and a police scanner to start this job. I'm like, he's operating at a frequency that is just unlike anything you've ever seen before. He's just pulsating with this madness. You can almost smell, it's like that weird chemical reaction alchemy thing that happens. Is like, I don't know how to describe it to anyone. I know that you've had these experiences because we've talked about them before personally, but it's like sometimes dangerous people are in a room and it smells different. Like the room just goes, it's like, this is bad. This person's bad news. I can, the changes the quality of it. And his performance in Nightcrawler is something where I'm like, smells like he changes the way you feel even watching it now, like so many years later. I'm just like, this is a masterclass. This, the whole thing is a form and function, and his performance and Dan Gilroy's clarity of what he wanted, just really special. Like, yeah, unbelievable.
No, it's unbelievable. And you know, it's you know, what you're saying about the tone he strikes, you know, vibes are real. Like,
yes.
whole theoretical school called affect theory that
yes.
studies the fact that when you can walk into a room where two people have just been arguing, if they're still in the room, but it's not a psychic thing. It's that you are trained to pick up on cues that are subconscious and subverbal, and that vibes between people are absolutely real. And you transmit a tremendous amount of information while ignoring the actual content of your speech. And like, and Lou Bloom, again, he doesn't fool anybody.
No.
Not the security guard when he meets him, not the pawn shop owner, none of these news people, nobody. Like, even like Riz Ahmed's character is desperate. Rene Russo's character is hungry. These people do business with him because they have to, because of the world we've built. And it's so fascinating. My other like big thought that is tied into this is that this is not a normally structured movie.
No.
Because there is no character development.
Nope.
Louis Bloom is exactly who he is. The moment you meet him, you're not really clear on it because they cut away. He might actually kill that guy.
Oh yeah.
Meet him. He is stealing scrap metal and is accosted by a security guard. And then you see him assault him. And the next thing you see is that he has the guy's watch on. Now the amount of damage or fighting you would have to do to somebody to do that is significant. So he might have killed that guy. He might have just beat him so badly that he's able to take his watch. And that's the first 5 minutes you were introduced to this character. And so it actually progresses not like your normal three-act structure, but in something closer to like a comedy structure, which you see in sketch comedy called The Game.
Yes.
Which is like a UCB school, and I think some other ones, but I'm not that well versed, but I know a little bit about it. And the idea of The Game, you see it in Key and Peele sketches. Key and Peele sketches are structured this way. You introduce an idea, and then you find out like what's the funny version of it, and then how much farther can we push it? How much farther can we push it? And you just keep pushing and pushing, and you're saying football player names that are funny, and then you're saying football player names that are a little funnier, and then you take it to the point where you're saying dolphin sounds for the football player name, and then you end the scene because you've reached the end point.
You've reached the zenith, yeah.
Yeah, And nothing changes. It's just you repeat it, but you up it, and you repeat it, and you up it. And that is the structure of Nightcrawler, is that it starts with him filming accidents and getting too close, and then he pushes those boundaries a little further and a little further and a little further and a little further until you reach the end and the climax. And essentially, that's as far as he needs to go to tell the story that we're telling. And going past that would be ridiculous. And then the movie ends. And he hasn't changed at all. All he has done is has moved up.
And he's a great success. He's a rousing success by the end. It's funny because in 2014, when lots of people wrote about Nightcrawler, obviously the focus is Gyllenhaal. Everyone's talking about Gyllenhaal. I do like this turn of phrase from Peter Travers from the Rolling Stone. He said, "A Nightcrawler curves and hisses its way into your head with demonic skill." And I think that, and A.O. Scott was like he was like, it's a modest, it's effectively executed, and it's entertaining, but he calls it clammy and overwrought, because I think the clammy feeling is what you're talking about. It's that you're feeling it there and you're doing it, and every scene has this kind of perverse edge where it's like Rene Russo, who needs him and is hungry and is being fed by this, you know, this kind of disgusting and deplorable behavior that she can be at arm's length for. I'm always struck by Riz Ahmed, his partner, towards the climax of the film, dies, and Gyllenhaal films this, exquisitely composes this gorgeous first-person experience of like a cop shootout at a diner, watches a car chase, his partner dies, and she's like, your partner dies. And the way that they are so intimately connected while she's like telling him all the awful things that he's just witnessed and has no feeling, he's completely apathetic towards it, has this like, there's a weird like post-coital sexual energy between them when it happens. And I watch that scene again and I'm like, God, this movie is just dealing in such the darkest things that people do to stay fed. And so it's really, there's just something about it. There's just something about this movie at every part of it. And like, again, the choice of actors, like Bill Paxton, who, you know, is most famous for chasing twisters rather than chasing crimes, you know, pops up in this movie. And even though he's kind of a seen it all, you know, kind of guy, and he's done it, he seems to also understand that people live and die. And this is why the work is valuable. Whereas Gyllenhaal could care less. It's about the angle. It's about the composition. He starts manipulating crime scenes to make them look more visual. You know, he's more concerned about his angles in a police interrogation than any of the accusations that are there. His manipulation of crime scenes for story. It's like there is no lengths he won't go to, and yet he's got a bunch of interns that work for him at the end of this movie, and they've got like little cute polo shirts with his brand on it. It's like, it's the most awful thing you've ever seen. And yet it is what it is.
It's funny because he is so unlikable. There's one moment that this really hit me this last time watching it, of like, just this, like, the, like, you're right. The, like, he is unfeeling. He will do whatever he has to do. But he is clearly like hungry for something that he's incapable of having, which I think is, if you want to analyze the movie this way, which I wouldn't necessarily do, he obviously has some kind of personality disorder that prevents him from actually connecting with people. And so there's a scene where he's in his apartment alone. All the scenes in his apartment are a little sad because he is so alone. It's so small. He's like, you know, watering his little plants, which is a great way to make somebody likable, weirdly, because especially a lonely person, when you see them watering plants, you can feel the hunger. They can't even handle a pet, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a scene where he is sitting on his couch watching TV and he laughs and he looks over his shoulder at somebody who isn't there.
Yeah.
Like, he is looking for somebody to have the connection with when he is laughing. But he's he knows he's in an empty apartment, but he looks like, he says, who else saw that? Who else can I laugh with and connect with? And so there really is this sadness to the core of it that does not make him a sympathetic character in some way that I'm like excusing it, but it's a layer of humanity that like kind of makes it all feel more real. Because I think if he was purely cold all of the time, I think maybe it would feel more clammy. And I think that, you know, I understand that critic's reaction, but man, this is noir. Like, what do you want? Like, this is like nasty shit.
Yeah, everyone's guilty. Everyone's guilty. And that's what this movie is unabashed. It's like everyone's doing so. It's like there's that, you know, there's a great Chappelle joke slash story where he's talking about, he's like the end of apartheid in South Africa should have been a bloodbath by any measure of history. Mm. Had they not just said the system incentivizes people to be awful and therefore we need to prosecute the system. So we're not going to prosecute the individuals who participated and benefited from the system. We're going to encourage them to talk so that we can understand how to basically destroy the system once and for all, this system of oppression that, you know, not unique to South Africa, but unique in its own brand of oppression. Yeah. And I think that that's the whole point of this movie in many ways. It's because it's like the system is what Dan Gilroy is skewering, and he's using Jake Gyllenhaal's Lou Bloom so much of that, but you're watching the systemic behaviors and the systemic apathy that's happening, and even characters that are vastly more human and vastly more real and have a lot more life experience and clearly have a lot more human empathy and clearly have another. It's just like ratings is all that matters. It's the only currency, because then it equates to immediate clicks or money. It's like people having bad faith, shitty, awful takes on the internet, like because they get the best clicks, etc. And it's just like that whole behavior, and this is the most extreme version of it. You're watching the system of all these people go around because that's where the money is. It's like that. It's just this corpse chasing money of it is there. And so people start doing all these awful things and lose just the most extreme person. But the stuff that starts to be more perverse and more weird is like the Rene Russo character and Paxton. How far has Paxton gone to do this stuff? Riz Ahmed is like witnessing all this deplorable stuff, and he's just there like wondering if he can get a raise like any other person who's in a job. It's like, I work really hard. It's a really fascinating, fascinating, incredible movie. And I think at the time people were like, yeah, they were like, the critics at the time were just like, it was a bit too extreme for them, perhaps in the acting. And it was a bit that they thought maybe that the metaphor of what the movie was going for was too extreme. And I would argue that it may have even been too subtle, because it's still hanging around. It's still so essential, this text. And I think it's really special. I think 10 years on, that's why it's still going to hang around and why we're talking about it today, is because it's got that level. It's hitting on that right frequency. And sometimes you're not ready for how cutting something is in the moment, but after 10 years, it's aging beautifully.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think actually there's a lot that you can compare this movie to, not just in tone or other obvious, ways to my, Michael Clayton.
Yeah.
In that it is a movie that is too good for the reception that it got.
Yes.
And too cruel about America, and too cruel about the system that we live in for most people to really kind of enjoy. And again, that it's a movie that people will continue to point to. This is maybe a little farther afield, but Children of Men strikes me as another one in this
absolutely
realm of movies that are like, honestly, maybe a little too good in their own ways.
Yes. It's like Alfonso Cuarón is a filmmaker who people are more readily like excited to talk about his third entry in the Harry Potter franchise, about how good a filmmaker he is. And I'm like, guys, Children of Men exists. Yes. Just for a moment, can we pump the brakes on the third Harry Potter and just remember the Children of Men exists? Maybe one of the greatest science fiction films of our era, like of this century, exists. And people are like, yeah, he's a really good filmmaker. And they're talking about these other films. I'm like, just pump the brakes, stop, go to Children of Men and just watch it. It's one of the most incredible films ever made. It's like, it's just that simple.
I you know, maybe this is me being, this is going to be a weird form of optimism that I'm saying, I'm being optimistic here, but I think that the time for these movies is coming back. This stuff is cyclical. And I think that people with what's going on in the world, with the violence that's coming from the police in this country, you know, from all the bullshit that's going on in the Middle East, and, you know, the rank oppression and slaughter that is happening, people think that means people are going to turn towards happy things, but that's not what we see.
No.
That is not what you saw in the 70s when we were, you know, in Vietnam and we were seeing, you know, little kids with napalm scars running. That did not lead to a big boom in happy-go-lucky fare. It led to zombie movies and all those great Vietnam movies and just like the 70s in general. And I think that there is an undercurrent of violence that runs through everything that has been submerged for a while, and it's coming to the surface now, and people are seeing it. And when they're seeing that, they're going to need art to help them deal with it. And I think that Nightcrawler is a movie that can help us deal with, you know, the facts on the ground, the facts of what we call crime and what we don't call crime, what we call violence, what we don't call violence, what we want to see, what it means to be thrilled by this stuff, and yeah. also to be repulsed by it, and how repulsion is its own type of thrill. And when you, you know, you cannot scroll down your Twitter feed without seeing dead children. That this stuff is going to have to be dealt with. And I think that, you know, people are writing articles about why The Fall Guy failed. Now, I haven't seen The Fall Guy. Maybe it's great. But is that really...
I would just say it's a hoot.
Yeah.
It's a good, a very, very serviceable date movie. Would be a lot of fun. Two charming, good looking people. It's not reinventing cinema.
Sure. But I just wonder if maybe, you know, and again, like, I was just saying, like, we're listing all these movies that have had a very long time to rise to the surface. And Nightcrawler, I pitched a local theater on doing a screening of Nightcrawler, and they said, oh, people won't come to it. I've been to one. I went to one last year at American Cinema Tech that was well attended. But I think that there is something about this movie, and maybe it is like it is the very purposeful decision to center it on a person who is as weird and unsettling and bad as Lou Bloom is. Whereas, you know, like you talk about, like, obviously my work is in this area, and my new book does have a Nightcrawler-esque character in it, but I do think in general I am more interested in the Rene Russos of the world than I am the pure psychopaths. I don't want the people who are succeeding because of their personality disorders. I want the people who are in this world and succeeding and know that it's not great. That, like, that, I mean, maybe even Rene Russo, but there's also like the blonde guy at the movie at the TV station who's like repulsed by this but still comes to work every day, and those tend to be the people that I write the most about. And you know, trying to figure out what night crawling is, I think maybe something about making a very contemporary film, like I was saying, is like night crawling in its own way is kind of dead now.
Yes.
Because what's happened between 2014 and today is now everyone has a camera in their pocket.
Yes.
And I mean, that was starting to happen in 2014, but it was not what
and not a 4K high definition,
yes,
you know, Google or Apple optimized, like you can shoot a nighttime scene, not require any lighting, high definition, just on your phone, no matter where you are, follow things, have apps that are police scanners as opposed to actual police scanners, you know, those sorts of things. It's like, it's evolved. And then what outlets are still paying the amount? Well, they're probably an online outlet. You know, there's some online outlet and someone finds it on Twitter or someone sends it to them, and then they license it as their own, and then it gets shared a billion times. You know, it's that there's a whole bunch of different currency there, but there's still a way forward, but it's not like it was in Nightcrawler. He didn't need a great camera. You don't need a Dodge Challenger.
No.
Those things.
What I have done in my book is the idea of somebody who, instead of trying to hustle around and find things to sell the news stations, is he live streams.
Yeah.
And so he is kind of just putting on a show, and maybe he'll get lucky and something amazing will happen, or maybe he won't. And if he gets good pictures, he, you know, he has a public feed and a private feed. But it's, you know, I did base it a little bit on a real guy I found on Instagram who drives around and he takes photos of murder scenes. And the other thing he does is he goes down to the Blade, which is the big sex worker area in South Central LA. And he'll just take pictures of the working girls. And it's very, frankly, exploitative. It's like a lot of pictures of girls in thongs leaning into cars, and then shot of a guy who's been stabbed, and then a shot of a homeless guy who's all OD'd and leaning over. But he, as far as I can tell, doesn't or barely doesn't sell any of it. He just has subscribers. So I think that's, if you're going to do it, that's how you do it. And so that's the character in my new book does that. And so like you said, I haven't done it recently because I've been living in Portland for a TV show for Criminal. But I have gone out at night on the weekends in South Central with a police scanner, which is illegal to operate, by the way, in the city of LA, in a moving vehicle. It's against the law. You know, I've gone out with our friend Travis Woods. We've driven around. Went out with my buddy Adam Frost, who is a crime fiction author and TV writer. And you know, like, it's an exciting thing to do. Like, you know, the most we ever saw was me and Adam were out one night, and we had just driven by a Popeye's chicken down in South Central that was just hopping like midnight. And then we heard on the scanner, oh, somebody just flashed a gun at that Popeye's. Like, we were right there. And so we turned around and we heard the description of the car, and we started following the guy, you know, and we were like a block behind him. We weren't like right on his tail or anything, but like he then turned down a side street and we start following him. When I say that Adam broke first, what I mean is like like a split second before I was about to say, we shouldn't be doing this. He said, we shouldn't be doing this. And I was like, no, you're right. We should not. We were like, because we were there before the cops were. We were following a guy with a gun. And we are not like, yeah, I know. It doesn't make any sense. And it was like, oh, okay. Yeah, let's not do this then. Well, I don't know what we think we're doing, but like, I don't. Yeah, let's turn around. So we turn around. It is. Really
I just want to say, like, when Jordan was doing this, it was around the time that we were talking very frequently. Not for podcasts, just catching up. Our friend group had a little pandemic film club. We were catching up on a weekly basis. And like literally we'd be finishing up a virtual chat with all of our friends, and like Travis and Jordan would be coordinating a time to go and do this. And I'd be like, guys, this is not, I mean, I live in Australia. It's different, but it's like, this is not doesn't sound like a fun idea. Like, it sounds interesting for research and the stories are amazing. But at the same time, I'm like, this freaks me out. I don't want you guys to get hurt. I don't want you guys to be night crawled. Like, someone finds you with your police scanner in South Central LA, like, not in a good way. I just want to, so Jake Gyllenhaal's career has moved along pretty steadily from here. I just want to pass on Jake for just a quick second and talk about Renee Russo, because you brought her up just before. And I think she's such a fascinating and incredible actor, and she's had a really interesting career. And like, just ever so briefly, like, if you have a look, you know, she's a mother, she's married to Dan Gilroy. So, you know, this is like, you can see her popping up in some of his more recent stuff, because, you know, she's gone through some things in her personal life, and she's starting to now be a bit readily, you know, available to discuss it. But like, she was a model. She comes in, one of her first movies is 1989 is Major League, which is 1989. Okay. She's in Major League. She's then in Lethal Weapon 3, In the Line of Fire, Outbreak, Get Shorty, Tin Cup, Ransom, Lethal Weapon 4, The Thomas Crown Affair. She's in a couple of other not so great movies in the 2000s, but like, that's like 89 to 99. She's one of the biggest movie stars on the poster movie stars that you've seen. She comes back in like the 2011. She's in Thor. She's in Nightcrawler in 2014. She's in The Intern. She's in Velvet Buzzsaw in 2019 and Endgame in 2019. But she doesn't really work. And so I think that her character Nina in Nightcrawler is truly special, because she is a phenomenal actor. We don't see enough of her. And it's such a meaty and gristly, chewy performance for her to sink her teeth into, that I continue to be amazed that we got that from her. Like, Gyllenhaal's in freaking a million movies and a million thing projects, but one person I can continue to go back to and marvel at is definitely Renee Russo.
It's interesting. I know, first of all, you're completely right. She is so fantastic in that movie, and it is not a flattering role in a lot of different ways. I mean, look, I want to be careful here, because Renee Russo is a beautiful woman, and is a beautiful woman in Nightcrawler, but I do think she is styled in a way to like kind of bring out her age and to make it clear that she is a woman kind of, again, on the edge of teetering off into something. And you can feel that in her performance. And because what she's asked to do is so, that role could be such a landmine for an actress who isn't nimble.
Yes.
Because it could just, because the things she says are ludicrous. You know, she says these insanely like racist things or sexist things, or she just doesn't care. It's just all what bleeds leads. And that she, like, you know, again, they very wisely do not get into whatever weird sexual things happen.
Yeah, it's all implied. And I think that scene of them talking about that final shootout is about as much I want to engage with the idea of the sexual currency that's happening between those two that you could possibly. Oh. It's almost too much. It's like if it went over into that, it's like already Lou Bloom is awful. But you know, like sexual blackmail is something else.
Oh yeah, no, and the decision to not portray that is good, because I think it would push the movie over into a place where it's a Michael Haneke film, you know.
And, yeah. And
I don't think that's not what they're going for. But like, no, she's outrageously good in it, and it's a role that again could be very easy to fall into caricature, and she completely. Saves it from that. You know, just to double back to what you're saying about the post-coital nature of when they talk, there is actually a moment in that final car chase when I believe it's when the cop car, it's when the crash happens at the end, where I can't remember if it's Riz Ahmed or Jake Gyllenhaal or both of them basically come. Like they make noises that are like it is literally the climax. And so even though there's a little bit more that happens in the film, afterwards, between that and the post-coital moment you're talking about, I think that's very intentional. That, like, again, if you take this idea of what I was saying of the climax of this film isn't when some kind of story turn happens, but when the thing has happened where you can go no further than this, that this is where this story must end. It is literally presented as more of a sexual climax than a story climax would be. So I think that's very intentional. I think the way she talks to him is very intentional. So I do think all of that is baked in.
It's also, Dan Gilroy is a fascinating entity. His brother Tony is obviously another amazing screenwriter family, you know, he's currently off making Andor with his brother, like being in the core writing room of that movie. He's done a bunch of other things. He's, you know, co-written The Bourne Legacy. He's got Nightcrawler under his belt. Kong Skull Island was his. Roman J. Israel Esquire, Velvet Buzzsaw. So it's really interesting to see that, like, this was his like pièce de résistance. And like, as you said with Michael Clayton, like, that's his brother's text. It's almost like those two movies, you can see the DNA of like this manifest distrust of those things. And one is an East Coast and one is a West Coast. And it's like, they are, and one is got its nose in the gutter and one is trying to have the face of decorum and things like that, and not show all the lengths that Michael Clayton himself, Clooney's character, has to go to like get things out of the gutter. So it's so fascinating that the way that is played with in this movie, that these two brothers, very similar dispositions, placing things on different sides of the United States, but playing with some of the same themes, have tackled them slightly differently as well. It's really interesting how that's happening. And Andor, as crazy as it might seem, is like one of the most politically on point series. Like, it's a Star Wars show that is engaging with really deep themes. I think it was a bit of a balm for people who are used to all of these TV spin-offs being kind of hot garbage and just money grabs, but having a real heart and a real soul is something that they're clearly bringing to it. And I just love that he tackled, you know, Nightcrawler so effectively back then. I'd be interested to see more Dan Gilroy something, to see if he's still got something in him, and hopefully at some point more Rene Russo doing anything. That would be really lovely.
I don't want to go on too much of a tangent, but have you rewatched In the Line of Fire recently?
Yes, I have.
it's got a lot going for it, but but Clint Eastwood's the way that he flirts with her is some of the most poorly aged, like,
it's
noxious
bad.
Garbage that you'll ever see.
It's bad.
Yeah, it's that was the last. I mean, John Malkovich is so great in that movie. I'm not saying the movie isn't worth watching, but you watch it now, and you're like, I can't believe we were
just him busting, like, being a sexist pig, and then, like, yeah, that's what gets Rene Russo. I'm like, that lesson, people took the wrong lesson. Like, be a douchebag, and maybe someone as hot as Rene Russo. Whereas something like, you know, that 90s period for her, like, I've seen Major League a million times.
No, me too.
Outbreak is sensational. Get Shorty, she's fantastic. But the Thomas Crown Affair for me is like, that's one of the great. Her as Catherine Banning, she's unbelievable as that character. She's amazing. Could watch that movie 100 more times. That's a great one. Nightcrawler here, her humanity is aching. And her desperation is so affecting. And Lou is crazy. And also, I know you love good character names. Lou Bloom, great character name.
Great
character name. Like, no, 20 out of 10.
It's absolutely Lou Bloom. It just rolls off the
tongue. Rolls off totally, the tongue.
Yeah.
And it will never be Lewis. It's Lou Bloom. Like,
it's
Lou Bloom.
Because Louis Bloom is not a great name, but Lou Bloom. Lou Bloom. Yes. Little LA trivia here. Let's see. Is the locations. So a lot of the exterior work is filmed on a, like, maybe a 2 or 3 block strip of Western in Koreatown. So both the first scene that he successfully films where the man is carjacked or whatever, you see the stabbing, that takes place about a block away from the Chinese restaurant where the two killers are confronted by the cops. I drive by it all the time. It's a very distinctive building, that Chinese restaurant. I think about it every single time I drive by it. And a lot of the other, like, you know, interstitial car work, it takes place around that part of Koreatown. And the other thing is, so the house where the home invasion murder takes place.
Yes.
If you would like to see more of that house on film, go to your whatever app you have that has The Mentalist on it. Go to season 6, I believe. And there's an episode named Violets about what if Patrick Jane and the crew went undercover with an art heist mob, and the majority of the action of that show takes place in the house where the Nightcrawler murder take place, and that episode was written by me. So I have been inside that house.
Talk about writing your way into one of your favorite movies. It's like Jordan is like, he's like, yep, we should scout this house. This is good. This is good.
I just remember standing in the house, like, when we were scouting it, going, wait a second. Wait a second. It's pretty cool. It's a crazy house, and it's just, you know, there are only so many giant mansions that people want to rent out to be scouted. So it's not crazy. It's not like some insane coincidence. It was just pretty fun. Yeah, it's a great LA movie. It's a great. I love the montage where he's saving all the file names, and so everything that you don't see him film. But if I recall correctly, one of them is Baby Stabbed.
Yes.
Which is just, it's such a sleazy movie in its own way, because it does revel in the same things that, like, it doesn't try and make it not look amazing when all those car chases are so. Or just him driving at speed. It's so gorgeous. And, like, LA is shot so well. And
the final composition of that police shootout where the killers, just by coincidence, the police go into that diner and they run out just before the final cars tip over and all that sort of stuff. The composition that Lou manufactures, because you're seeing his footage and the way that it integrates his footage with the footage that we're seeing live and his perspective, it's exquisite by the end. And that's also very problematic, because it's just before, just before his sort of interrogation sequence, that it's so powerful. You're like, you see him in the first scenes and it's crummy. I'll fast forward this. It's him in front of his car waving, you know, to a minute and a half. That's where the good stuff is. But this, it's like, no, it's that perfect take. And you're like, oh my God, that is incredible. Like, that, it actually is beautiful in its own disgusting, awful, and, a, you know, sort of forthright way. It's It's abject, but it's, you can't take your eyes off it.
Well, again, not to quote too much for myself, but my character Jake in my new book, as he's leaving a crime scene where he's just photographed the dead body, and he's having a hard time pulling out onto the street because of the traffic jam that's outside, because it's a crime scene. And he just says, you know, everybody taps their brakes when there might be blood on the pavement. And which is true. And yes. Yeah. And again, like I certainly know where I sit in that, like I'm not clean in that regard. And that's what, you know,
no, none
again,
of us are. You can't help it. It's insane. It's like, it even happens today. It's like anything. It's like that sort of sticky beak. Like you see it in traffic all the time. I think anyone, anywhere, if you're driving on a freeway, like there's some inexplicable slowdown that you're driving, you're like, what is going on? And then you see that there's an accident on the other side of the road, and you see that people are slowing down from like, you know, 80 to 100 miles an hour to slow down to like a crawl of like 30 miles an hour, or in Australia to be like slowing down from 110 k's an hour down to like 40 k's an hour, because it's like, am I going to see something disturbing? Yeah. And you're on the other side of the road, they're nearly causing accidents to just rubberneck, you know. It's like, it's, there's an impulse there that you can't control, and you try and you hope that you're above it. But this movie, you know, doesn't have that hopeful outlook. It's like, some people are like, oh, I hope this happens. And there's a great line that I love, which is like, wish in one hand, shit in the other, see which one fills up first.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. It's like, this movie is that. It's like, no, people like the shit. People like the grossness. There's something reptilian about it. We have to look.
Well, and what I like about the movie is that it doesn't sugarcoat it. It doesn't just say people like violence. It also makes it clear that people like being afraid, and that the specific, yes, crimes that they want to photograph are the kind that make the people at home afraid. They, yes, want to hear, like, it says, crime is moving into the suburbs, that there is a element that is coming for you. Like, that is, and like, how much of true crime today, which is, you know, so much both about women being murdered and consumed by women. I have friends who I respect, who I've heard say that, like, women watch true crime because they're like training themselves about what to do if they're ever in a dangerous situation. And I know you're not. No, you're not. You are experiencing the pleasure of being of terror, a terror that is safely held off into, that you have, like, you know, exported into this screen or this book or whatever it is, and it is a safe way to engage with it. I'm not criticizing anybody who does that, by the way. I'm just saying that's what
the true crime genre it just massages and manages the release of the drug of pure terror, whereas, mm, like, some folks will not watch pure horror or pure terror or those thrillers that get really deeply under your skin and affecting as a psychological exercise, but they'll watch true crime because there's a pleasant boppy music and a documentarian's voice that comfortingly sort of presents the facts as they are examined. And I'm like, yeah, that makes it more consumable. It's not any less disturbing.
No.
The content, but the delivery system. It's the difference between smoking a cigar and smoking a grape smelling vape. You know, like, you, mm-hmm, know what I mean? It's just like, one of them is like pleasant. You can do it inside. Another one requires expense. It stinks. Your house will smell, probably set off a fire alarm.
Yeah.
It's going to disturb people. It's, you know, there's a fair amount more spitting and mess and grossness. And it's like, yeah, there's two delivery systems for the same thing. And one of them is okay to be done inside in the quiet pleasant trees of your lounge room around your children, and one of them is something you need to do outside. It needs to be away from me. I can't do it here. So that's what I find is, like, some of the most deeply horrific movies I've ever seen, like, are nowhere near as affronting as like a true crime documentary. The formal storytelling and the affect that they have on you are vastly different, because the intention is to terrify you. Whereas a true crime documentary is veiled as informing you.
Yes, but it does still say the same purpose. Like, you know, there's a subgenre of this that I have seen in Mexico, where they are magazines that are just incredibly graphic pictures of cartel violence.
Yes.
which people are living through, and I'm not minimizing that, but there are also a lot of people who aren't living through it who are buying those magazines. And it's the same thing that, you know, there's real dangers for women. Obviously, violence against women is horrific. I just learned that we go down this dark hole that it's more dangerous to be a pregnant woman in America than it is to be a policeman in America. And the number one cause of death for pregnant women, at least in America, is homicide. And like, these are like real facts that like you have to deal with in the world. And so I'm not judging anybody who, however they deal with that, that's their business. I'm not judging them, but it is interesting to talk about. And it's interesting to observe, you know, what it is that we're reenacting and what it is that we need to see reenacted, particularly when there's that connection to reality, to this idea that this is real, this is happening. It's just not happening to me, but it could happen to me, but it's not. But I'm experiencing it virtually constantly. It's a fascinating thing, and I'm not, again, I have my own things, and you know, so I'm not judging anybody, but it's so baked into it. And I like that the movie Nightcrawler is not judging the audience.
No,
the audience is sort of like, you're left to say, well, what else? Because you switch around, it's going to be on all three channels.
Yes.
Like, you're being fed this. And so people like it, but it's like blaming people for being unhealthy when every restaurant in their neighborhood is a Popeyes or a McDonald's and they live in a food desert. Like, yes, people make choices, but they make choices in, they're always contingent choices in an environment, in a reality. And so, like, you know, people watch this stuff, but that's also what they're being fed. You know?
And then the smart filmmakers, people like Dan Gilroy, tackle something like this that has to serve some of the same itches or scratch some of the same itches of what we're being fed, but then twist it and then make people think. And like, there's a bit of self-examination in here. Like, do we have a role? But he's not indicting the audience. If anything, he's talking about the system. He's talking exactly that. He's like, question the system that we... this is what we're being fed. Why are we being fed this all the time? Who is qui bono? Who benefits from that?
Yes.
So he doesn't judge. He doesn't judge that. But he talks about then, and he's not even in many ways, he's not judging the characters who start to become part of the ecosystem, because that's what it is.
Because that's what it's very different than, like, it's just suddenly making me think of Blowout. Just De Palma in general, and his constant indictment of the audience along with himself and this voyeurism of the moving camera and all that. And this movie, for all the looks through the camera, isn't really doing that. It's not the same. And I do think maybe that is partially because of Lou Bloom being such an alien character, but it's also just not there in the filmic language. It's just not there. You know, the camera doesn't really linger. Like, it's not, when you do his POVs, it's not, for the most part, some kind of true grotesqueness that you're witnessing, other than maybe when they go through the home invasion site. But like, so I don't think that's his intention, is to make the audience look at itself. It's more saying, look at the system that we're all locked in.
Man, this is a special movie. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about it. You're one of a kind as a creative, and I love talking to you about anything, and I particularly love talking to you about this movie. Thank you so much. For folks who are listening, Jordan's making a new TV show, which I don't think will be out, but probably will be in the depths of being made while you guys are listening to this. So I would just recommend going and getting Everybody Knows, which is one of my favorite books ever. Get Last King of California, which is now finally getting its stateside release. I've had this book for a few years. I've heard about it for even longer than that, it feels like. It's finally getting its states release, but check out all of Jordan's stuff. And of course, if you've never read She Rides Shotgun, which is his Edgar Award-winning novel as well, get your hands on that. Man, thank you so much. This has been a true treat. And season 6 of The Mentalist, Violets, I believe.
Violets is the name of the episode.
Yeah, you can go and check out some, you know, if you're interested, if you're one of those people that likes to spot the same movie set in multiple pieces of screen culture, you can go and find that as well, man. Thank you so much for your time. It's always great talking to you.
Thank you, man. Always a pleasure.
Wow, what's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.